It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up later in the 9 o'clock hour, Kevin Pang's going to be here. Kevin, of course, former Chicago Tribune food reporter who turned filmmaker. His film For Grace is actually now available for download on iTunes, Amazon. This is the movie that was about Curtis Duffy, the chef, and his restaurant Grace, about his childhood, very tumultuous childhood, to becoming one of the most successful chefs in the world. So we'll talk to Kevin about that this big week for him. Also, John Jughead Pearson is back. John is the guitar player for Screeching Weasel. He's also a ensemble member of the Neo-Futurists at the Neo-Futurarium up in Andersonville. He's celebrating 20 years with that company. And just this week, I think on Friday, he flies back to Japan to continue his work as a wizard. And I'm not joking. That is, we're going to talk to him about what it takes to be a wizard. He's a wizard. He's a Japanese wizard. The guitar player for the punk rock band Screeching Weasel is now a Japanese wizard. So we will talk with him coming up about that. My guest tonight at the big table once held a pretty prestigious job. She was the Midwest director of the Environmental Protection Agency. And back in 2008, she moved very quickly to deal with a contaminated water crisis in a small Michigan town. Sound familiar? Well, the difference here is that Mary Gady was reprimanded and eventually removed from her post stemming from that response. Hard to believe, since the latest Midwest EPA administrator was removed for not acting faster in Flint, Michigan. Gady has dedicated her life to the environment. She served with the Illinois EPA. She served under President George W. Bush and his father. She continues to work as a president of her own Chicago-based consultant agency, Gady Environmental Group. So tonight we talk environment, disaster, politics, and preparedness with Mary Gady. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just talk about Flint, Michigan, because this is one of these stories that we continue to see and more comes out. I mean, hearings today, you've been outspoken on this about the role of the EPA. You've had an interesting past, and we'll talk about it in a little bit, but what's your take on what's going on here? I mean, the EPA obviously does not look good.
Well, there's blame to go around, so that it starts at the city level and the emergency manager appointed by the governor of the state, who made the fateful decision to switch from treated Detroit water that had been serving the populace for decades to untreated Flint River water, and that's where the problem began. It might not have become such a problem if the laws had been enforced in the city of Flint and by the state of Michigan, which requires corrosion control, which would have helped prevent this more acidic water from leaching lead out of the pipes and into the drinking water of taps.
Let me ask, because when I hear that, I think, what recourse or what role can the EPA play when municipalities and governments make decisions like these? I mean, you really can't step in necessarily and say, that's going to be bad.
No, but and that's correct. And that you're not going to step in and substitute your judgment for that of the city government
right.
in making that decision. But you are going to ensure that the federal laws, and this is a federal law, the Safe Drinking Water Act is a federal law, is adequately implemented and enforced. And that's what didn't happen here. The state failed to fulfill its responsibility as a delegated program from the federal government to implement the law in the way it was supposed to be, force the city of Flint to do the appropriate corrosion control, do the sampling in a way that was appropriate, and make those results transparent to the population. So that was a failure of a delegated federal program. When a state doesn't do its job, the EPA retains its federal authority to take action.
Now, there's some, I don't know, just sort of gray area when they talk about delegation and whether or not the EPA can come in and take control and that kind of thing. And it's been thrown around in Flint, Michigan. But they do have the power and the authority to say, we're in charge.
Yeah, totally. These are federal laws. And in fact, the primary people that are responsible for it are the people that work at US EPA. It's only when a state demonstrates that it's got the appropriate regulations, staff, capacity, ability to implement it, and it's a whole laborious process by which they get authority to run the program in lieu of the federal government, does a state take over. But they are still not the only people responsible. It's still a federal program. And so EPA still does oversight. They step in and sometimes file enforcement actions when they think the state isn't acting. It's actually an ongoing sort of battle between states and the EPA about who's got control of these delegated programs.
Let me ask you, because the thing I think that grabs everybody's attention is the idea that any town in America can have this kind of problem with their water, especially a town that is in the shadow of a lake like Huron. The other part is political. The part that, you know, it becomes more and more clear as people do investigations that the bureaucrats and the politicians knew this was happening far before the people did, or, you know, the country. Talk about both of the how politically something like this can happen, where, I mean, whose job is it to sort of come in, step in right when they find out and say, let's get this done?
Well, I don't think politics goes into that. That's where the bureaucrats have an obligation under the law, a real legal obligation to notify the public about the sampling results that they're getting and any adverse health effects. So the first failure here is in terms of that, is not political. It is of the bureaucrats charged with that responsibility not to do the things they were supposed to do. And that's both at the state level, and then when they fail to do it, it's at the federal level.
So the politics comes in when people start covering stuff up.
That's right. And I mean, I'm one of those people that believe strongly that the environment should be a nonpartisan issue or a bipartisan issue if you're in support of it. It's like education for me. And so the fact that it's become a little bit of a political football, and it was today in the hearings in Washington, D.C., is painful for me. This is an issue that we need to come together on.
We're talking with Mary Gady. She's the former Midwest director of the EPA, and she served until 2008. When we come back, I want to talk more about your time at the EPA and get a better sense and understanding of what it's like to work in that bureaucracy, in that federal program. Because, you know, we've heard so much about what they can and can't do. I'd love to know how it works, what can be done. You know, so many things we can learn from someone who used to run it. Mary Gady, my guest tonight in the Big Table. Stay with us. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the Big Table, Mary Gady. She's the former Midwest director of the EPA. She also served at the Illinois level under Governor Edgar, the Illinois EPA, and she now runs her own consultant agency, Gady Environmental Group. Mary, you spent your whole—I mean, you've really made a career out of being involved with the environmental protection.
That's correct. I first got interested in it, believe it or not, in 1970 on the first Earth Day, when my high school put together an Earth Day program, and I helped at it. And
wow.
So I realized at that point how interesting it was, how important it was, and how it could be a fascinating career.
When you got into the career, I mean, you've done a lot of you've been a public servant. You've worked in the like I just said under Governor Edgar. Talk about how you got involved with being a public servant and working for the state.
Well, as I said, it for me, it's always been a fascinating area because the environment covers everything. So you can be, as I am, an environmental attorney, or you can be a biologist, a chemist, somebody that focuses on communications. There is just a whole variety of things that are included in environmental protection. And so I knew that it was an area I wanted to get involved in, and I had the good fortune, to be hired early on in my career by US EPA Region 5 and started out as a staff air attorney, working on some really interesting cases.
You have a very sort of mailroom to the top story.
I do in terms of EPA. It's true, because I started out just as a staff attorney and made my way up through the ranks and then ended up in Washington, D.C. as the Deputy Assistant Administrator for the nation's hazardous and solid waste program.
So one of the great things about your vantage point, I mean, you've served under so many different administrations, but you've also served in so many different decades of this country's sort of, and I mean it in the way that you've seen attitudes change.
In the way that it makes me.
Yeah, I know. No. But I mean, but you've seen this country, even from, you know, the first Earth Day to what we see today. I mean, you've seen the attitudes change, and when it comes to protecting the environment that we live in.
I know, and it's been fascinating for me because people tend to forget we have done such a good job in this country collectively and by implementing the laws that the U.S. Congress passed of cleaning up our environment, that people forget that 40 years ago you could hardly drive along the tip of Lake Michigan on a sunny afternoon without your headlights on because of the pollution from it. They forget that the mm-hmm. Cuyahoga River burned with regularity until we put in place the Clean Water Act protections. We forget, and we forget how many ozone days we had in Chicago in terms of bad air quality.
Right.
And so the important thing is to understand it's because we have very rigorously enforced our environmental laws that we have such a clean and healthy environment today. And I think sometimes that works to our disadvantage because people don't understand the importance of continuing to enforce those laws.
Well, this is an interesting state when it comes to the environment. I mean, you served under Governor Edgar, and this is a state that has a lot of interest in coal. downstate. You have a lot of coal. You have a lot of, even if you just talk about the region, I mean, just right across the border in Indiana, a ton of industry, steel industry, that kind of thing. But there's a real relationship with manufacturing here. And a lot of the manufacturers, especially the big ones that create a lot of jobs, they also create a lot of pollution. So talk about the state of Illinois and that sort of give and take that we've had in our history over the years.
Well, I mean, there is no doubt it's a big state. It's one of the older manufacturing states in the country. We clearly have coal in the southern part of the state, and we have a lot of agriculture. And so we have a lot of diverse economic sectors in the state. But one of the things that I think has gone forward well in Illinois is that we have put in place laws that are fair and that get the job done, and that Illinois has an incredibly good track record in terms of protecting the health of our citizens.
Let me ask you, so after the Illinois EPA, you went back to Washington. You were in 2006, you were brought in to be the Midwest director here in Chicago under George W. Bush. But you were the Midwest director, and you know, at that time, you had to deal with the same kind of issues that we're kind of seeing in Flint, Michigan, when a big manufacturer maybe has a pollution runoff into the rivers, things like that. You had your own sort of crisis that you had to take on. Talk about your relationship to the issue I'm talking about with Dow Chemicals.
Well, there's a little bit of similarity, no doubt, to what happened to me when I was running the EPA in 2006, and as this current crisis in Flint, and that is that I was sitting at my desk one day when my staff came and said that routine sampling under the law that protects against hazardous waste being put where it shouldn't be, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, that routine sampling by Dow Chemical in the Tittabawassee River had turned up a sample of 87,000 parts per trillion of dioxin. And dioxin is a known cancer-causing compound. It's a byproduct of industrial manufacturing of things like Agent Orange. And the Dow facility in Midland, Michigan had been manufacturing it, and air pollution and water pollution had caused this excessive level of dioxin in the river. The health-based standard at that point was 10 parts per billion.
And so what'd you do?
It was orders of magnitude. And so I looked at my staff, who were understandably very concerned about it. We were aghast. We got Dow on the telephone immediately and said, you need to come up with a plan to address this.
So that's how you usually do it. You go to the company and say, you got to come up. What's your plan?
Exactly. And when they failed to come up with one by the spring, because it was the winter and there was not a lot you could do about cleaning up a river system in the middle of the winter, we used for the first time ever the kind of authority that the region could have used, or EPA could have used earlier in this case, order authority, and said there's an imminent and substantial endangerment to the health of the people in this river system. You have X number of days to tell us whether you're going to clean it up under a plan we approve, or we're going to do it.
Well, I got to ask the question. I mean, how did Dow Chemicals react? I mean, they're a very big company with a lot of interests. I mean, they probably didn't like that the EPA was telling them they had to clean it up.
I think they were surprised because it had been years of inaction and years of stalling by the company on a variety of things. They're very adept at playing the system and figuring out ways to extend things or submit things in an incomplete fashion that it causes you to do yet another draft and whatever. But I will say at about 10 o'clock on the last day in which they were supposed to tell us whether they were going to do it or not, a cadre of their attorneys walked into the regional office of EPA with a signed agreement.
Mary Giddy, you're a freedom fighter. You're an environmental freedom fighter.
I think I was doing my job with my staff.
Well, okay, so we're going to take a break and get to the news, and we'll come back and talk about what were the repercussions of that move. Because, you know, it's so interesting to me, because it would seem on paper that anyone who works at the Environmental Protection Agency is going to jump in and try to take care of something like that, because that's what you're protecting. But it's not that easy, especially when it comes to bureaucracy and politics. And you found out quickly in the next couple of years about what standing up for the environment was going to cost you. We'll come back. We'll talk with Mary Giddy. She was the former Midwest director of the EPA, and she is my guest tonight on The Download. Thanks for being here, and stay with us. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. With me, Mary Giddy. She's the former Midwest director of the EPA. She's my guest tonight at the big table. She served everywhere. She served at the Illinois EPA. She served under President George W. Bush. as the Midwest director, and she now runs her Chicago-based consultant agency, Gady Environmental Group. We're talking about Flint, Michigan, but you know what? It's bigger than Flint, Michigan, because you have a story that's similar. Because in your case, when you had to deal with a contamination issue, it's not the same as the water issue, but a contamination issue of a river system that was connected to Dow Chemicals. And you did it. You forced Dow Chemicals to come up with a plan, and that's where we ended the story before we went to the news, that they came in and signed. What happens after that?
Well, this was different in the sense of this was contamination in the sediments of the Tittabawassee River system. And so what essentially we did is we ordered them to clean up these hot spots, which they did over the course of many months. In the course of that sampling, we found another horrifying hot spot of 1.6 million parts per trillion. And the standard, again, is 10 parts per trillion. So we added yet another order to this.
I mean, this is a big story. I mean, this was because there were so many stories at the time and even before that of you know, chemical companies, other manufacturers, just sort of skirting the law, being able to dump stuff in the river systems. And that's like sort of a known American story, if not an earth story. But yeah, so you took action.
I took action. But in fairness to companies, remember, we didn't have these kind of stringent environmental laws until the 1970s. So a lot of the damage was done before these laws were in place. So then the issue is people who were culpable for that, for that, coming forward to clean it up and make sure.
And
that
it costs money and they don't want to spend the money. That's pretty much it, right? So what happens? Because, you know, I tease this story out that there are repercussions. Not too long after you're asked for your resignation. Talk about that.
Well, we used our order authority to compel cleanup of the river system in these hot spots. That did indeed happen. And then we knew that as we continued to do our investigation, we found out that a 50-mile swath of Michigan all the way to Lake Huron from Midland, Michigan was contaminated. And actually leading into the lake. And so we knew that there were going to be many more cleanups necessary, including in the city of Midland itself. And so in the course of doing that, obviously it cost a great deal of money, and the company, I think, became very unhappy about the way it was going and the pressure that was being put on them to clean up
right.
The site. And at a certain point in the process in which my staff and I were very committed to the cleanup of this and moving forward, I was asked to resign.
And it wasn't necessarily like it was 2008, but this was before the Obama administration. I mean, you were working under George W. Bush. So this was the administration coming to you who was running EPA at the time saying
and saying we have a policy disagreement. You want to do this and we don't want to do that. Or we want to do it differently. I am pleased to say, and especially with the hardworking staff at Region 5 that really did all the work on this, that even today the cleanup continues in that area of the country, and there's been cleanups in the city of a lot of residential lots over the last couple of years and city parks. It's an area in which there's everywhere has been posted no fishing, no drinking, no swimming, no whatever. It's very contaminated.
Let me ask you, as a person, when we set this story up that you spent your life in environmental protection, working a lot for the state, for the government. Were you surprised that your actions led to a sort of an ask of your resignation?
Yeah, I was surprised, actually, because I felt that we were fundamentally doing what we were charged with doing. That when you take a job as a regional administrator, you actually swear an oath to uphold the laws of this country. And clearly that's what we were doing. So, yes, I was surprised.
So, you know, making a transition back to what's happening in Flint, Michigan, one of the big issues with that story is inaction. It's the exact opposite of what happened with you. Is there any way, and I'm sure you're going to say no, but is there any way that your story is lore in the way that, you know, that administrators and the EPA, they're like, well, you know, you don't want to act too fast. You saw what happened to Mary.
I don't think so. I think they're really quite different situations, and that would be really inexcusable because then you wouldn't be fulfilling your responsibility to the public to watch out for their health and safety. I don't understand what happened, and I think as the weeks go by and the investigations and the oversight hearings and the emails and whatever come out, we will all get a better understanding of what was going on. But from what I have seen, I think that EPA in this instance was trying to deal in a very plotting, bureaucratic way with the problem. And so they were trying to address the underlying problem with the lack of corrosion control in the Flint water system. They were trying to deal with MDEQ's sort of intransigence in terms of how to deal with the samples.
So essentially paperwork. They were doing a lot of paperwork.
They were dealing with underlying issues, but they, in the course of that, lost sight of what the heck these poor people were drinking and the real crisis and public health crisis that was emerging that required emergency action.
So the issue, and I think that's what the hearings are about, is and the hearings are becoming more political than bureaucratic. But the issue really, it wasn't the fact that the EPA was short on resources or couldn't, and that they just, it's not that they chose not to, they just didn't do it. They could have done it.
Absolutely. So the authorities are vast. And I mean, I used many of them with my staff back in 2006 through 8 and the Dow Midland, Michigan crisis. And these are things like issuing the order authority that was finally issued by EPA on January 21st of 2016, which could have been issued months and months ago, compelling the city and state to.
I mean, there's talk that they knew what was happening and even double checked what was happening by early summer.
Well, concretely at senior levels they did, and we'll find out more as more documentation comes out. But EPA itself knew as early as February, clearly as early as February.
A year ago,
2015, that there were elevated levels, significantly elevated levels.
Now, they'll say that they went and did, and like you did, they went and said, okay, to the Michigan government, and they said, what's your plan? They said, and the Michigan government fibbed a little bit.
Well, I mean, I can only tell what I saw today in the hearing, and they held up an email of the state in which the state assured EPA that the appropriate corrosion control that would have prevented the lead from leaching from the pipes was in place. And so that was clearly a misrepresentation. But meanwhile, because of the way the program works, the EPA is aware of the sampling results that the city water department was required to do under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And so EPA had its own knowledge of what was going on.
It's fascinating. Obviously, you've been vocal. You've been active in talking about this because, you know, you were I think it was a commentary or an editorial in one of the Detroit newspapers. You've talked a lot about this. I mean, as a person who has been involved with the government, involved with EPA, when you see something like this happen and it gets to the point where it's at, where there's just a whole system of drinking water is not available for people. And I mean, this is a full blown crisis. What goes through your mind?
I mean, I've used the words horrified, appalled, aghast more in the last 2 weeks than I ever have in my life. There's not words to explain how upsetting this is to somebody who knows what could have been done and should have been done. And so we talked about the fact that there's emergency order authority. When we were dealing with the Dow crisis, we called in the Centers for Disease Control. We went out and did our own sampling. There are many instances across this country in which you find sources of contamination impacting drinking water wells, and the EPA gives out notices immediately, provides alternative water supplies, mm-hmm. bottled water, tanker trucks, whatever. None of that happened here, and that's really a failure, I believe, of leadership.
Mary Gady is the former Midwest director of the EPA. Let's take a break. When we come back, I'd love to talk to you more about our water supply. Because, you know, I don't know much about it. You just mentioned, you know, when this thing happens, when there's well problems, they slap something, tankers come in. How often this happens? Also, the effect of old pipes and lead on the water supply, which, you know, I was reading something that this is not. I mean, the idea that they are testing and certain people are coming back positive, that's just the tip of the iceberg. This has been a year. Michael Moore talked about, you know, he was drinking the water and taking showers and doing things in Flint, Michigan, and would have been exposed to this. So there's a lot that goes into this story. So let's continue the conversation with Mary Gady when we return here on The Download. Stay with us. Three 312 says, thank you, Mary, for all that you've done. I appreciate it. Isn't that nice to hear?
Very nice to
hear. I would say an EPA administrator doesn't usually get that kind of...
Not often.
Talking with Mary Gady, she's a former Midwest director of the EPA. She was forced to resign in 2008 over a difference of, I guess it was philosophy or policy in the cleanup of a contaminated area of Michigan, Dow Chemicals. It was a big story at the time. And we're talking about Flint, Michigan. And we're talking about the environment in general. You know, I always feel like that this is happening all the time. That Flint, Michigan is happening all the time and we don't hear about it because it doesn't all, you know, you always like if you get on Facebook and you have yet one friend from high school is like, look what's happening in Arkansas. Nobody's talking about it. Or are all the kind of environmental concerns that we have. I mean, I kind of see the EPA as almost like the black ops of environmental protection. How often does something like Flint, Michigan happen where there's like lead in the water or there's some sort of contamination that we don't even know about?
Well, I mean, we hope Flint is an anomaly and doesn't happen very often. But, I mean, I've already read reports that there's some similar incident going on in Ohio. We know that in 2001, there was elevated lead levels found in the Washington, D.C.'s water because they switched the corrosion treatment they were using. So we know that this happens, but we know primarily the problem with lead in water is a function of our aging infrastructure and the fact that until really the 1990s, we didn't ban using lead pipes or filters
lead.
And
yeah,
so forth
right.
In order in our systems, our water supply systems. In fact, many places you were ordered to use lead pipes. And so in Flint, they have 600 miles at least of lead service lines. We have a lot of them in Chicago.
Yeah, right.
And so you need to do this corrosion control because it's your best line of defense against the lead.
And this isn't new
the pipes.
To the federal government. The federal government understands the danger of lead. We saw it in lead paint. We saw it in, you know, lead is the gas. We've seen lead become public enemy number one. It's in pipes, but the federal government knows of this problem.
Yes, of course. And the Safe Drinking Water Act has a specific rule dedicated to, it's called the Lead and Copper Rule, the LCR, and it has specific provisions about how to prevent lead from coming off the pipes into the drinking water supply system, which is by applying something called optimal corrosion control, which is generally applying, for example, in the Detroit system, which had been feeding Flint their water for decades, they were using something called orthophosphate. So it was a phosphate, and over time it coats the interior of the pipe and prevents the lead from sloughing off. And that's what happened when the Swiss system switched. The city of Flint switched in 2014 to Flint River water,
right,
not treated water. They did not use any of that corrosion control.
You're going to see more of this, Mary, right? You're going to see more because as the infrastructure crumbles and the resources are much more limited for local governments, for federal funds, you know, as we really become cash strapped. Well, are we going to see more of the kind of crumbling infrastructure become environmental problems?
Well, I think that there are safeguards in place, but one of the problems here has been, and many people have complained about this and talked about it, the lead and copper rule that is supposed to provide all these safeguards is almost 25 years old. It was written by EPA in 1991. Many people believe it has too many loopholes in terms of how you do the sampling to test these systems to see if they're secure. That they lower the concentrations that are actually there and have all sorts of other problems. EPA has been talking for many years about updating that law. Gina McCarthy, the administrator of USEPA, has just announced that they will accelerate that process.
So they have to, right? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. And so what needs to happen is, quite honestly, people don't have to worry if the laws that the agencies are enforcing are good. And they're doing their job. And in fact, because of the concern of lead, there is no safe level of lead exposure. None. Zero. You don't want any lead in your system. You don't want to be exposed to it in any way. But what needs to happen is that the people in charge of this, the water supply systems, are supposed to notify their customers of the sample results. They're required to do 2 6-month samplings every year. They need to put that out in a message to their customers. It's that kind of transparency that has been missing here. And so one of the things that needs to happen is we need to assure that people are following the existing laws,
right,
and then make them more strong.
It's like a lot of things. I mean, it's an uphill battle because you're dealing with a lot, like I said, a lot of cash-strapped communities and less state funding, things of that nature. Let me ask you, too, about philosophy, because we see all the time with the EPA and more importantly with the environment, when I think of things like climate change and so forth, this sort of idea that it's polarizing, that it's partisan. You have spent your life under Republican administrations. Governor Edgar here in Illinois, George W. Bush as a president, but you are a Republican. You've talked about that. Do you feel like that's an accurate stereotype? The idea that it's a partisan issue and that the left believes that the right doesn't care, and we see all the clips that come on and somebody saying, "I've got a snowball in Congress." Like, talk about the relationship between politics and the environment.
Well, I think it's more partisan, obviously. Anybody who watches what's going on in Washington understands that environment is a political football in Washington, but not to the average American. Poll after poll in the United States shows that all Americans believe that clean air, clean water, you know, safe food supply is important to them.
Yeah.
And so they're not quibbling about the need for environmental protection. And that's also true in terms of climate change. Poll after poll is showing that the majority of Americans thinks we need to take appropriate action to safeguard against it. So it should not be a partisan issue. The fact that it has become one is very, very tragic.
Yeah, why do you think it? I mean, it almost feels like the Environmental Protection Agency is something that people go after when they become, you know, when we switch administrations. Like the Environmental Protection Agency needs to do this now that I'm president, or this if I'm president. Why do you think it is? Why can't we just this be like almost separate from administration?
Well, we've always said when we're in the EPA that we're doing a good job if everyone is suing us, because because you're the enforcer of the laws, and so you're right. Putting in, you know, you're issuing permits, you're out there causing companies to have to incur costs to put in safeguards, control equipment, whatever. So you're not popular. So it's easy to come after you in sort of a very generic way that you're being too rigorous and you're doing bad things. And then, of course, the minute that you aren't doing the things you should do, they come after you and say you failed.
I mean, we're seeing that what happened with you in 2008. And we're seeing what happened here in 2016. I mean, they're different sides or polar opposites, but the same issue of like trying to find that balance of what is appropriate for the Environmental Protection
Agency. Yeah, Justin, I think you've captured something, which is a certain schizophrenia in the system of and the attitudes about the EPA.
Mary, I mean, I ask my guests all the time on this segment in the Big Table just about Chicago. And, you know, just what it means to you as a person who lives here. But I want to ask you, as someone who's been a part of, you know, say, sort of protecting the environment, how is Chicago? Is Chicago and the people that live here, are we environmentally conscious? Are we ahead of the curve?
Absolutely. Chicago's got an amazing sustainability program. It's been in place now. Mayor Daley started it. Mayor Emanuel's continued it. I mean, I urge people to go online and look at the current sustainability report for the city of Chicago that just came out in December. Some remarkably good things are happening here. I think that Illinois and the city of Chicago have taken environment very seriously.
Good. So you're not going to go anywhere else? You're going to stay with us?
I love this city.
Good. We need people like you, Mary. Mary Gady is the former Midwest director of the Environmental Protection Agency. She's worked at the Illinois EPA. She worked under President George W. Bush and President George H.W. Bush, right? And also, you're a Chicago-based consultant with the agency Gady Environmental Group. Mary Gady, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Justin.